Subcommittee on Higher Education meeting for Wednesday, January 31st. Representative Lim, Representative Greenock, good to see you. Thank you for being here on time. I appreciate it. I'm going to open a informational meeting on private colleges and universities. Thank you all in advance. The people have come to talk on this subject. We look forward to learning as much as we possibly can in the next hour and 50 minutes that we have before we have to give over the room. We already have our first presenter up, so if you'd be so kind, sir, to identify yourself and start the educational process for us.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Gary Ann Dean. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association. This is my 12th legislative session, regularly. We always appreciate the opportunity at the start of a legislative session to update you on the state's independent colleges and universities. It's a fairly large group of relatively small institutions that account for a significant enrollment and significant degree production, significant economic impact, and significant civic betterment for the people of Oregon. I begin by thanking the legislature on behalf of these institutions and their staff and their students and their alumni and their donors and their friends and their neighbors for all the ways the legislature has partnered with these institutions over many decades. And I won't list all those ways, but after 11 sessions, I could probably start that if I wanted. At present, there are 33 private institutions authorized to grant degrees in Oregon. That's more than public institutions. Their combined fall enrollment is about 38,000 students this past fall. That represents about 18% of the total post-secondary enrollment in Oregon and generates 25% of the total degree production in the state. At the baccalaureate and graduate level, that's 30% of the enrollment and accounts for 33% of the degree production. These 33 institutions are extremely diverse in size, in program, in ethos, in selectivity, and in price. By the way, you can see all of them on the front page of this first attachment that I gave you. All the pink schools at the bottom. Some of these institutions offer only religious degrees and don't qualify for any state student aid. Some of them offer only graduate degrees and therefore don't qualify for any state student aid in Oregon. And some are based out of state and consequently don't qualify for any state student aid. And some of them are for-profit and therefore don't qualify for any state student aid. Among the 33, however, there are 19 that are Oregon-based, regionally accredited, and nonprofit. And those 19 are the ones that pay my salary and make up the Oregon Independent College Association. Among those 19, there are about 28,000 students, 19,000 undergraduates, and 9,000 graduates. Those 28,000 students will spend almost $1 billion per year in college costs during this current school year in the Oregon economy. And that's without any multipliers. More than half of my students, about 15,000, are Oregonians, and the profile of those Oregonians is nearly identical to the profile of Oregonians attending our state universities in gender, in minority percentages, in age, and in family income. Average retention rates at my institutions are more than 80% from freshman to sophomore year. Graduation rates for baccalaureate degrees are 54% in 4 years and 64% in 6 years. In spite of these and many other impressive statistics, Oregon's independent colleges and universities garner less than 1% of the state's higher education budget. And all of that strictly in the form of need-based student aid to the very poorest of Oregonians. Our legislative agenda for this year is all about partnering with public institutions and state government to improve the ability of all Oregonians to make post-secondary education choices that are accessible, affordable, and appropriate for their skills and ambitions. Last fall, all across my OICA institutions, we saw a slight increase, about 2%, in new undergraduates from out of state. We saw a large 21% increase in new undergraduates from community colleges in Oregon. But we saw our first ever decrease 4% in new undergraduates from Oregon high schools. That mirrors OUS experience and is especially alarming since Oregon already scores low in national comparisons of its college-going rate, as I think you've already heard in other testimony. Consequently, during the 2007 session, the OICA institutions will be supportive and will want to participate in legislation that increases the size and distribution of Oregon Opportunity Grants and reshapes their calculation around a shared responsibility model. Secondly, we'll want to be supportive in legislation that enlarges the proven Aspire program, bringing thousands of new volunteer college access mentors to all of Oregon's high schools. We'll be interested in legislation that extends the state tax deduction for 529 savings plans from the current $2,000 per filing to $3,000 for single filers and $6,000 for joint filers. And there'll be legislation to do that. And finally, in legislation that provides state funding for a $100 529 college starter kit for every newborn baby in Oregon. You'll see legislation to that effect, too. We think that that would send a powerful message throughout the entire state that every child in this state is post-secondary education bound, and we need to treat them that way. More generally, our legislative agenda will also include attention to opportunities for partnering with state and local government and with our sister public institutions. First, in developing and sustaining a rich blend of high-quality academic programs. Secondly, in helping students more easily transition from high school to college and from college to college. Third, in leveraging more private investment in all of our public and private sector students and institutions. And finally, in enhancing the affordability of higher education in both sectors to all low and middle income Oregonians. Again, thank you for inviting me, the independent higher education community, to the table, and for recognizing that we all share a common mission to improve the quality of life and the prosperity of every Oregonian now and into the future. I've shared with you some of our statistics and charts, and I'd be happy to share more of that with you during the session at your call.
Great. Mr. Dean, thank you very much. We have a problem apparently with that microphone there, and I wonder if you might want to shift over to the other one, and hopefully that would... Oh, there you go. That's a shift right there.
Okay.
Folks in the audience, if you have a cell phone, we actually need them to be not just turned down but turned off. Otherwise, it's Representative Kremel's phone, I think. He's doing it right now. Otherwise, he does mess with the system there.
I'm the one.
You're the one. Thank you.
Me too.
Thank you.
Whoa. It's not just...
All right. So actually, it's everybody.
I'm green like us.
Everybody but me, because my cell phone's in the... Yeah, okay. Committee members, would anyone care to start with questions from Sardine? Representative Greenlick.
Yeah, you talked about that birth thing. Yeah. Would you talk to... I mean, it reminds me of my experience where my folks made me put a third of every money I ever got into my college fund from the time I was about 4 years old. And it's the sort of thinking of just assuming you're going to college. Could you just talk a little bit about...
A little bit. I will be more prepared to talk specifically about it when the bill gets to the committees, but what I can tell you is the State 529 Savings Plan started, 6 or 8 years ago. It's a board that's chaired by the state treasurer. We have, I believe the number is somewhere around 100,000 accounts, almost $1 billion now in less than a decade. What I recall when I think about that is something called the I Have a Dream program many, many years ago. You may recall the national program. There was a moment in Oregon back in the early 90s where a couple of attorneys, as I recall, approached a third grade class over in the inner city of Portland and said, "You guys stick to your studies and stay out of trouble and we'll guarantee your college education." The Oregonian did a wonderful article on it, and I've still got it in my files, thank goodness. And they interviewed the parents and the teachers and some of the family friends of these 30 young people. And it was just amazing the way that promise changed what happened to those young people from that point forward. The parents were saying things like, on Saturday, we don't just go to the beach anymore. We go to museums, and we do things like that. The third grade teacher was saying, this used to be a class of problem children that I worried about. Now it's a class of college-bound children, and I treat them differently. And I think if we can create that sense across the whole state that everybody in this state is college material, that it could change the way we do a lot of things here in the classroom and thinking about the future of our state and what's important to it. And it's a very small investment. We estimate about 50,000 new births a year in the state. If they all took the $100 and actually invested it, and then because of that started to put the family money into it, just think of the huge return of private investment you would get for a $5 million annual public investment. And it just sends messages way into the future. So I'm excited about it. I hope all of you will be too. Every time we bring it up, we get a lot of people who say that sounds like a really attractive idea. So we'll be inviting all of you to come up with more reasons why we should do this.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, sir.
Any questions?
Yeah. Yes, some I have.
Representative Lim.
Mr. Chair, as I look at this chart, the second page, yes. It looks like about 18% of the domestic, the race of a domestic and proportion of a foreign student. Is that 18% is the out of the total student number in our state? At the bottom section, of second from the right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I'm trying to find...
All the way, if you look at under there's the column that says foreign percent,
yes,
on page 2, and all the way down at the bottom, there's the figure of 18%.
Yes.
And I believe Representative Lim is inquiring about...
Is it 18% of the total student population of our state?
That, Representative Lim, Chair, that yellow row down there,
yes,
is the percentage of all the students above who are attending independent four-year institutions. So of all the foreign students in the state, 18% of them are at our independent. Yes.
That's quite a few.
Specifically, if you go way up to the top of the page, the red row,
yeah,
over to the right, to the foreign column, 745 of the students in my 19 schools are foreign students. And you just drop down to the purple column, there are 10 foreign students in the other nonprofit schools, 87 in the for-profit schools. And in the green, 3,766 foreign students at the state universities. And then the blue, dropping down further, 831 foreign students at the community colleges. By the way, I don't think anybody else in the state keeps track of records for all 33 institutions in the private sector as well as the public sector. So you get a picture of the entire higher education community on this one page. We have numbers of pages like this, as Representative Clem can tell you.
Very good.
So,
Representative Crumb.
So, in following up then, so the grand total is all the students in the state. There are 199,000 students going to all. That's all students going to a university or college in Oregon that are either part of the OICA, other nonprofits or for-profits. State institutions and community colleges and OHSU, correct? I mean, that's all college students in the state of Oregon in a four-year institution.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, yes, in two- or four-year degree-granting institutions. This is a fall headcount snapshot, 193,759, okay, and this was the fall of 2005.
199.
Excuse me.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Gary.
Good afternoon, Representative Clem.
I wanted to run an idea past you that the committee, I think, is going to be looking at once the Legislative Council folks get caught up on all the last-minute ideas. We had a group come in to talk to us about talented and gifted students in high school, and one of their points was if you can keep their attention span and other things, you know, during high school, you often lose them when it's time to go to college. And sometimes they have been, you know, approached by Ivy League schools, you know, what have you. And, of course, I'm sure you would agree that we have prestigious institutions here that would, in my opinion, be well served to be able to attract these students. I know now your institutions and members are working on that on their own. What I'm wondering is, would it be helpful to have additional assistance, maybe some financial incentives, but maybe not so much just financial incentives, but something where the state, the governor, the prestige of the legislature, if there is any, that is brought to bear to be a partner with you and the OUS in recruiting and trying to get these folks to stay in Oregon or come back if they leave. So I'm envisioning, I think my legislative council calls it sort of the SWAT team on the best and brightest. And this is where if your recruiting office has identified a student who is in Oregon, a high achiever, it's very likely he's going to leave Oregon, but they may be the next Bill Gates. Can we put together some state resources to work with one of your presidents for that couch visit where you try and get them to stay in Oregon? Does that seem possible or interesting to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Klim, Oregon has historically been, at least for the last 20 years, I'm not quite sure it's going to hold up this year, but has been a net importer of students. We attract more than we lose. It's always been right on the cusp. In fact, there are more out-of-state students at the independent colleges than there are in the public institutions. I'm not one to think that we should spend a lot of state money on attracting bright students. I think they will find their ways to the right schools. I think the state money needs to go to attracting, to helping low and moderate income students afford to go any place. I think that's a much higher priority in our minds. There are lots of scholarships at the institutions, public and private, to attract bright students if you can. But the state dollars need to be invested to help everybody have those opportunities. And I think that to a large degree, the academic merit scholarships are already out there. Private people like to fund them. Donors like to fund them. So it's not quite the answer I know you wanted, but no. That's my honest answer.
If I might follow up. And actually, thank you, Mr. Chair, we're on the same page. I'm not talking about any new state scholarships. In fact, the way I started thinking about this was people kept talking about the HOPE program in Georgia, and let's spend billions of dollars just to try and get, keep – there was that statistic, if you recall, about the number of 1,500-plus SAT earners who stayed in Georgia because of it. Well, you also, paid for everybody else to stay as well. So I started thinking about, you take all the scholarships and resources that already exist, but you put them in the hands of a governor. No, I'm now, Margie, I'm now encumbering your boss on some things, sorry. They go and have the couch visit with Lee Pelton. No new state dollars at all. It's just, when you have a profile, it's like having, formerly Dennis Erickson or, Mike Riley come and sit on the couch of your young person. It's persuasive. So we're really talking about the prestige level of the offer the state of Oregon makes, not financial. And I think it actually takes some of the momentum out of the drive to spend tons of state resources on it when it's really more the personal touch that I guess I'm thinking of, without new scholarship programs, but just marshaling the existing ones and having it delivered by spokespeople who might impress the parents and the student a little bit.
I'd be happy to chat more about that with you. I'm not quite sure how that...
We'll have a bill we might deal with at some point.
Thank you. Mr. Andine, thank you very much for your testimony. I have a couple questions on some of the materials that you offered us that haven't really been pointed out. I appreciate this information very much. There's a page in the packet that's titled 2004-05 State Grant Aid for Students.
Yes.
And just to note for the committee, where our state currently ranks with the U.S. average at 11% and the Oregon average at 4%, and we are down there towards the bottom. Also, to note the debt load, which I also find very interesting in terms of students on the last page of the packet, students graduating now from our public institutions with a debt load of over $19,000, and students graduating from the private nonprofits at something very close to that. Still way too much for young people to start off with, but it's interesting. Can you elaborate any on how it's happened that these figures have, number one, grown so significantly, but also tended to come to an almost equal level?
Mr. Chair, there are a couple of interesting figures on this particular page. One is that 67% of the graduates in the public sector have debt, and 70% in the private sector. And that sort of confirms what earlier testimony I gave, that our family income profiles are very similar. And we have other materials to show that. But as far as the two debt loads being so comparable, there's a lot more assistance available inside many of the private colleges in the form of donor contributions and endowment funds over the decades that are dedicated to scholarships, which tends to help equalize the cost to the student or the burden on the student. We even find that the students in both sectors are working about the same amount and working surprisingly large amounts, which is alarming. And we need to point out that all these numbers that you're seeing on my charts today are about mostly 2 years old. The prior chart you referred to, Mr. Chair, where we were looking at our effort compared to other states on student aid. That chart will change a lot when the new numbers come out, we hope in March now, nationally, because you did make some serious investment changes in the last session in the Opportunity Grant, taking it from a roughly $44 million per biennium up to almost $80 million. And the governor's budget asks for another $30 million plus bump again this session. So we're hoping that we'll climb a little bit, but as these charts point out, you could double the Opportunity Grant and you still wouldn't be up to what the average state spends on need-based student aid. I like to say we're trying to get up to the level of mediocrity in our help for needy students. But this governor and this legislature has been moving in the right direction, and we're very appreciative of that.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Greenleaf.
On that same table, could you help me with the OHSU number? It seems extraordinarily low. Is that across nursing and dentistry and medicine?
I don't know.
I know the medical school number is something like 200,000. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf, I'd be happy to share with you the initial source data, which is something that we all across the country sort of depend on for this number, and maybe we can dig a little deeper.
It's hard to think of that as a four-year institution, too. Just an email note to me.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions, gentlemen?
I would, Mr. Chair, I would point out a few years ago when I worked at Lewis and Clark, and I've worked at both a private institution as well as a public institution, kind of following up on Mr. Andine a little bit, is we found that we had two types of students and financially. We had the students that had no money. And the reason that they could come to Lewis and Clark is because their need was so great when they filled out the FAFSA. When they filled out the federal financial aid form, we found that they had so much need, and if they were academically eligible, they could qualify for the president's scholarship and several other things. And so those students were able to come, as well as getting Pell Grants and Stafford loans and some other opportunities. And then we had the student that needed no financial aid at all. Their parents had plenty of money and could pay for them to probably buy the college, not just attend there. And so we didn't have a lot of the students that were in between. We had a few, and those were the students that were taking the work study jobs along with the lower income students. So there, and I would sort of say that one of the things in looking at this chart at the end with regards to the debt, that's one reason why I think you would see those numbers being so close in terms of the percentages, because I think that's one of the things that have, whether a student goes, because of the financial aid system, whether a student goes to a private institution or a public institution, they have a lot of the same opportunities. But the problem is we end up with those extremes, and it's the students in the middle that kind of get left out of the mix.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Cumlin, if I may just follow up on that, it's that middle group of students that we're really targeting with the increases in the Opportunity Grant further up into the starting to get into the middle income, and not very far, but far enough so you can at least call it the moderate income. But it's also the reason that we're excited about the state 529 plans, because you really sort of have to be paying taxes in order to get any benefit from making those savings. So they really aren't targeted mostly at the very low income, but they are targeted at the middle and upper income, and getting that pump primed for the future is really important to the state's taxpayers, to the legislature, and obviously to everybody in the state of Oregon. So, yeah, it's that middle income that we're all really focused on right now.
Very good. Mr. Dean, thank you so much for coming here today. We look forward to having you back when these bills come before us and to your partnership as we move through this session. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
While you're changing speakers, Mr. Chair, I would point out that there was a report from the Treasurer's Office to the Ways and Means Committee that I sit on, and it was very interesting from a standpoint of the 529 and how fast that fund is growing and the number of participants that it is bringing in, and more people really are taking advantage of it. So that's good to see.
Very good. We're going to switch subjects just slightly, members of the committee. We are going to focus now on English language learners with Yvette Weber Davis, Dr. Randy Hitz, and Dr. Hilda Roselli. Please, if you plan to come all at once, you're welcome at once or one at a time, however you are most comfortable testifying. You're all coming at once. All right. Appreciate the safety numbers very much. Appreciate you all being here, and when you do start, we'd like you to introduce yourself, please, to the panel, where you're from, and just to kind of give a little framing note, and I think I'm sure our wonderful administrators already conveyed this to you, but this subject has come up in front of our all three of our education committees, and we're only in our third week. It's come up several times in terms of English language learners and how our teachers are being trained to address the needs of those students. So I greatly appreciate you being here to let us know the status of the work and where we might go from here on. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair Buckley and members of the subcommittee. I'm Yvette Weber Davis, Director of Education Policy and Inclusion with the Oregon University System Chancellor's Office. In just a few moments, I will introduce my colleagues here. But I wanted to go over and provide some very brief and basic information to you about this topic and also about a larger initiative. First, I'd like to start by thanking you for the invitation to the Oregon University System to provide the subcommittee with information pertaining to the preparation of ESL educators. As you know, ESL, along with special education, science, and math, represent the greatest shortage areas of classroom teachers in our state. In addition, Oregon is experiencing shortages in auxiliary fields such as speech pathology and school psychology. I'd like to provide background information to you of the state's recent production in this area, as well as give you a brief overview of selected components of a statewide initiative to enhance the production of teachers in all fields. The August 2006 Oregon Educator Supply and Demand Report, commissioned by TSPC and the Oregon Department of Education, indicated that during 2005-06, there were a total of 114 new licenses issued in ESL bilingual to educators prepared in OUS institutions, and another 21 new licenses in this endorsement area that year issued to educators prepared through Oregon private institutions, representing a total of 135. Also during 2005-06, a total of 277 new licenses in ESL bilingual were issued to educators from out of state. Thus, during that year, a grand total of 412 new licenses were issued in this endorsement area. Of important consideration to the issues of addressing all teacher shortage areas are outreach and advising and also specific teacher preparation program efforts. Of course, also included would be the retention and professional development of teachers once they enter the workforce. That third bullet is beyond our purview today, so we'll focus on those first two. In terms of our statewide advising initiative to address all teacher preparation fields, I wanted to take this opportunity to give you a little information I'm not sure that you might otherwise be able to know. In recognition of current and future needs for educators throughout Oregon, OUS continues to work collaboratively with numerous educational partners, including private institutions, TSPC, Oregon Community Colleges, and ODE, among others. I'm pleased to report that through various efforts, we have moved to new levels of responsiveness around teacher preparation. As part of our efforts with the Education Pathways for Teachers project, progress has been made in areas ranging from curriculum to innovative practices. However, today I will touch very briefly on our statewide advising component of this project, as this is highly germane to discussion of teacher shortages in all areas. One important issue that we've discovered is that we must do a better job of articulating exactly how one goes about pursuing opportunities to become an Oregon teacher. From anecdotal information, we know that interested people typically need assistance to navigate the paths relating to course requirements, teacher licensure, and employment in various endorsement areas. Attached to my written testimony, you will find a bookmark that was developed as part of our advising initiative. The bookmark, a brochure, and an advising guide are available online, and the site is listed here. Since we began disseminating these resource materials last year, and that is to high school counselors, to two-year and four-year advisors and faculty, we have experienced more than 6,500 web views to the site. So the interest and the enthusiasm are there. That concludes my very brief overview of those two topic areas. I thank you again for your interest in teacher preparation. All three of us are available to answer questions, but I'd like to take this opportunity to turn the mic over to Dr. Randy Hicks, Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Portland State University, and in a few minutes, Dr. Hilda Roselli from Worcester.
Thank you very much. Members, we will hold questions till the panel is finished. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. I thank you for your interest in this topic and look forward to a conversation with you about it. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. I started as the dean at Portland State University in August, and so I brought a couple colleagues with me in the event that you have questions. They'll be happy to help out. Greta Cron is here and Linda Pullen, both with me today. Portland State University has had an ESL bilingual teacher preparation program in place since 1994, and our faculty actually provided leadership in this area and assisted the TSPC in creation of the state ESL bilingual endorsement, which became effective in 1999. Our program consists, as most programs do, of seven courses plus a three-credit hour practicum. But we do have one course that's a bit different. We do offer a special education course, require that actually as part of our endorsement. It's not part of the TSPC requirement. We have several full-time faculty who have taught in the program and continue to teach in the program, but most of the courses are taught by adjunct faculty. We are fortunate to have approximately 50 outstanding practitioners. These are K-12 teachers and administrators with at least master's degree level training who are among our faculty.
Dr. Hicks, I'm sorry, I neglected to ask you to identify. We have to have your voice identify yourself.
For the record, yes, my name is Randy Hicks.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And I apologize. I thought that was covered by Okay. To date, there are 480 teachers have completed our Portland State ESL bilingual endorsement, and over 230 are currently active in the program. And, of course, as you would expect, there are a lot of teachers who just want to take one or two courses to help them in their work, and we've had over 1,000 teachers who have taken advantage of that opportunity as well. I'd like to take this opportunity to also mention and talk to you a little bit about the Bilingual Teacher Pathway Program. It's a federally funded teacher preparation program designed to fill critical shortages of bilingual and bicultural teachers. Individuals recruited to the program are bilingual and are employed either part-time or full-time as instructional assistants by a school district that has an intergovernmental agreement or contract with PSU. Students are provided coursework necessary to complete elementary or secondary education programs and the ESL endorsement. BTP students receive financial assistance from the BTP grant. Funding for this program unfortunately ends this year. We're reapplying for another round of federal funds, and also I'm pleased to say that the Oregon University System has placed this program among its priorities for funding by the Oregon Legislature in this session. An ESL endorsement program, like any teacher preparation program, is intended to produce individuals who are prepared as entry-level teachers, of course. Employers have assurance that these new teachers have received the basic knowledge and skills to allow them to begin their careers or take a new career direction in working with English language learners in the multitude of very diverse Oregon school districts. Continuing education in the Graduate School of Education at PSU provides an additional professional development offerings that can help ESL teachers increase their knowledge and skills. Building on the pre-service preparation of new teachers, school districts plan and implement programs and services to prepare their new teachers to address the unique needs of the English language learners within their specific service areas. School districts provide professional development for teachers that supports the success of their specific programs and services. So I thank you for this opportunity to testify, and we're happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. For folks who might be listening over the Internet or on Oregon TV, TSPC is Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. So sometimes we have to just kind of make sure everybody who's linked in knows everything we're talking about. Thank you. The good mic. Hopefully that's the good mic.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Buckley, Vice Chairs Clem and Kremel, and members of the subcommittee. My name is Hilda Roselli, and I serve as the Dean of the College of Education at Western Oregon University in Monmouth.
Thanks, Annie. One way or another.
As such, I appreciate this opportunity to share with you our efforts at Western related to preparing qualified teachers to work with ESOL students. For 11 years, Western Oregon has offered ESOL and bilingual ESOL endorsements, the latter which requires evidence of proficiency in a foreign language. To date, we have recommended 616 candidates for endorsement through TSPC, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, 179 of which were bilingually also endorsed, meaning that they were able to teach in another language. That number has increased dramatically for us, and today I was quite pleasantly surprised when my staff were able to document that right now we have 174 more teachers in the pipeline this year alone at Western Oregon University. Our students earn the endorsement by itself or either in conjunction with our undergraduate program or our graduate program. Like Randy's program, it includes 5 courses in ESOL. We also include a technology course, and we also have the practicum that has to be conducted in a classroom with at least 25% of the students are ESL qualified. And then, of course, they must successfully also pass the Praxis 2 ESOL exam. Our program curriculum is guided by the national standards that guide programs in this area, as well as the National Council for Accreditation on Teacher Education. And what we've done is focused our curriculum around 5 major areas. Those include language, culture, instruction, assessment, and professionalism. And those mirror quite clearly some of the other domains that we think of in teacher preparation. We also reflect the Oregon English language proficiency standards, which are really used primarily to help teachers for lesson planning and also thematic unit development. In addition to our on-campus program that's serving either undergraduates or graduates. We also offer three off-site programs. This is our attempt to reach out to our school district's needs to produce more teachers, particularly in areas of their need. The first program is actually preparing bilingual Salem-Keizer employees to not only earn an initial teaching license, but also to earn their ESOL endorsement within that program. The other two efforts are offered off-campus in one in Corvallis School District that's serving both teachers in Corvallis and Lebanon, and the other program is offered at Chemeketa, and it is serving teachers in all of the surrounding areas that can drive into that campus. Our college has two full-time faculty tenure lines dedicated to this program, as well as nine qualified adjunct instructors with classroom expertise. All of our adjuncts meet regularly with campus faculty and are involved in all of the curriculum revisions and refinements of our program. While a source of pride for Western Oregon, the growth in our ESOL program has also been a source of concern. The needs of the program clearly exceed the current dedicated faculty FTE, and although we are hoping currently to add a third tenure line faculty member for next year, we continue to receive requests for program expansion, both from our districts and even within our online MET program. We've been looking at ways that we could provide an online program for our online MAT. Right now, we just don't have those resources to do that. Because of the urgent need to also recruit and prepare bilingual teachers who can deliver instruction in students' primary language, we are currently seeking funds from two sources for an innovative undergraduate bilingual teacher education program that we think builds upon Oregon's persistence, affordability, and access agenda in higher education. Designed in conjunction with the local school district, the program is going to recruit and prepare talented bilingual high school graduates who wish to teach in ESOL and bilingual ESOL programs. Entering as freshmen at WOU, candidates will benefit immediately from coaching resources that are designed to help them complete their degrees in 4 years, along with a very explicit focus in their curriculum throughout the 4 years about their role as teachers impacting student learning for ESOL populations. Faculty from education and liberal arts and sciences will meet regularly to discuss best teaching practices, assess the students' progress, and also study concepts related to how do we teach in bilingual settings as well as second language acquisition. Selected courses will be offered in Spanish, further modeling best pedagogical approaches for helping second language learners understand concepts, particularly in content areas. Throughout the program, the candidates will return to bilingual settings in our partnering school districts to complete field experiences and help foster post-secondary aspirations for K through 12 minority school-age students. We believe that Western is uniquely positioned to provide this program because of our nationally known teacher education program, our ability to attract first-generation students, and our commitment to strengthening our ESOL program even during challenging economic times. We believe this project holds great promise for addressing a workforce need in Oregon while refining a model that also increases post-secondary achievement for Oregon's growing minority populations. Thank you for your time, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen?
Gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I listen to the testimony from the three of you, that I hear we have a tremendous shortage of English educators in our state. And why, what happened that our state, you know, in such a shortage? It seems to me we have an abundance of lawyers, but we have a shortage of engineers and teachers. And could you give us some reason why this happens?
Where should we start? Go ahead.
I can think of a couple of reasons, Mr. Chair and Representative Lim. One is the tremendous increase in the number of students who need ESL education. Of course, you know that the population of Oregon is changing tremendously in that regard. So that's creating a much greater demand, of course. So I think that's Well, one of the primary reasons. The other thing is it's difficult to recruit people into these specialty fields, oftentimes, and which is one of the reasons that we have sought and federal funds to help us recruit people in this area. And I think it's what Hill is referring to too, is that they're seeking some funds to prepare a program similar to what we've been doing, I think, to recruit and retain more people in this field. So I think those are two things that come to mind.
I would add also, Chair Buckley and Representative Lim, that what is happening in Oregon reflects trends across the country, and specific areas in particular, in certain states even, have such huge influx of new populations and needs for ESL and bilingual education and other educator programs until the system across the country is somewhat overwhelmed in recent years, and seeking innovative ways to better serve the populations of their states. And here in Oregon in particular, I think we've been maybe even slightly luckier than some other places in that regard, in that we haven't fallen too far behind yet. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to really address the needs as they continue to confront us.
Dr. Sully, do you want to try the other mic to see if it, by magic, it might work for you?
Magic?
There you
magic.
Go.
Right. She turned off her cell phone.
That must be it. That was the cell phone.
I'd like to add two more additional reasons. One is I think that there's a comfort level that comes from familiarity with a second language, that if you do not already speak a second language, there's sometimes a distance that you feel in terms of being able to help other students who might be coming in primarily speaking that second language at first. And so for us, as with Randy, we're very interested in finding individuals who are already demonstrating a proficiency in bilingual speaking skills so that they have that ability immediately to feel comfortable with students who speak, whether it's Russian or Vietnamese or Spanish. If you've experienced a bilingual world, you're in a better position to feel comfortable with that. The second thing that I think has to be acknowledged, and I know it's impacted our campus, I can't speak for the others, is that there is a very competitive field out there for faculty who have doctorates, earned doctorates in this area. It's specialized, it's small, and when they come out with a doctorate, they can go pretty much anywhere. In my institution alone, in the last 6 years, I've lost three very qualified PhD candidates who could take higher positions and salaries in another place. I'm currently doing a search right now. I'm bringing four candidates to campus within the next 2 weeks, hoping to get one or maybe two of those candidates. But I'm fighting an issue there because it is a real competitive market.
Mr. Sir, follow up?
Yes, Representative Lim.
And I understand you have a federal grant for this ESL program. How much is it, and are you applying it again? In case if you don't get it, then what could we do?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Lim, we've had two rounds of funding for this program. Again, it's a program that enables us to recruit bilingual individuals into this field, actually helps them get their undergraduate degree and as well as their teaching preparation. The funding runs out this year. So we're applying for two separate grants right now from the federal government to do basically almost the same thing. But as I mentioned, the Oregon University system has also made this one of their priorities, and so we are actually seeking funding from the legislature this year. And it would make sense, given the great need in the state of Oregon, that Oregon would want to support a program like this.
Thank you. So I'm going to jump in just a little bit here. Do you know what the name of the program is that you're...
Our program is Bilingual Teacher Pathways.
Okay. Thank you. President Greenock.
Thank you. I think I have two questions, but they may relate to the first. I mean, they may relate to the other.
Go for it.
There is a move here and other places to create English as the official language of the state. How would a proposal like that affect your programs to teach English?
Well, I've been monitoring activities in Arizona, Colorado, and I came from Florida. Those decisions to make English a primary language are certainly well-intended. They do not consider the needs of children who arrive every single day, and they do not necessarily consider the limitation that sometimes a well-intended movement can make towards limiting the funding and services for children while they're struggling to learn that second language. What we know from the research is that you can learn social language within 2 to 3 years, but you cannot learn the complete complex language that is necessary to function in a sophisticated society or a technology-driven society. And in fact, I also work with English language learners at the higher ed level, and I've been following some very recent criticisms that are happening around the programs that are designed to quick turn around college-level students and help them learn English immediately. And what we're finding is they're not learning it as quickly as that we would like to see that happen, and it's showing up now in the employment dissatisfaction of those graduates and their ability to be successful when you move into complex content area.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, if I may, I think what you're suggesting, if that were to occur, it could change the nature of instruction in the K-12 schools, but I don't think it would reduce or certainly wouldn't eliminate the need for people that are specifically prepared in this area. You're still, even if you're going to promote English first rather than a bilingual approach, you're still going to need people who know how to deal with students with who are English language learners.
Can I follow up, Mr. Jones?
Representative, it depends on the question. No, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, for example, it's my understanding that a child learning to read can learn best in their native language before you translate that ability to learn to read in English. Would our adoption of an official state language in any way affect your ability to teach students in that way?
I think Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, it's my understanding, yes, that would impact that aspect of ESL. Is that right? That's my understanding.
Well, Representative Buckley and Representative Greenlee, I would probably suggest that it may, during times of shortened resources, fuel a desire to move funds towards away from serving students with those needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I definitely acknowledge and understand the shortage issue. I have a question just to see if you might be able to help me with if we had enough or for those 450 that you've just gotten certified that we do have. When they get into a school, I've toured schools and I've spoken with principals about how they kind of deal with someone, especially first, second, third grade, where they might create kind of a little special unit that everybody will come out during a certain period in the morning and work with people. What are the kind of best practices now that are occurring? In terms of, a lot of times a constituent of mine will think it's all taking place inside a classroom noisily in the corner while everybody else is, speaking in English. There'll be somebody else having their own little class in the corner. And what's the reality of what does happen and what should happen to help someone sort of get transitioned over?
Well, I'll take a stab at this, Representative Clem, and I don't profess to be an expert on this. I wish I had brought one of my faculty members with me who does this every day.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that there are different approaches that are working well within schools. I see immersion programs. I see reverse immersion programs. What's ironic is that we're trying to help more English-speaking individuals learn a second language. I mean, we're desperate for people at the college level to want to take a second language, to well-round themselves, whether it be Chinese or what have you. And so there are programs that are making some good attempts in that effort to exchange those opportunities for English-speaking students to learn that second language and vice versa. That's also happening in Native American reservations. I personally have worked with one up at Grand Ronde. We also, and I see I have some colleagues here who may want to add some advice to this as well, but I would also say that there are stages of development, and as we teach teachers how to assess the language skills of those students and design the kinds of experiences that those students are ready for, it may be a combination of efforts that's going to be best for any one student. I also personally am a great admirer of Woodburn School District. I think they are doing some amazing things because they have actually engaged their community in the education process along with the language mm-hmm. piece. So that when families come into those schools, they're immediately welcomed. They feel comfortable. Those students now are graduating from an IB school. We just accepted a student in from an IB class who graduated last year, Hispanic, bilingual, coming into a program in post-secondary ed. That's the kind of achievement that I think is also important for Oregon.
Thank you. Dr. Say, I'm going to mention it to members, too, that the Subcommittee on Education Innovation did receive quite extensive testimony from the Woodburn School District, which we can make available to anyone's interest.
That'd be great.
In addition, we did have a presentation yesterday. I think it's yesterday. My mind is fogging on time now. It's only the third week of the session. But on the changing demographics of the K-12 system, and that would also be available to any member who might have an interest in that. Representative Kremel.
See, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I think there were some other folks who
wanted
to
answer
the question.
Chair,
I had a follow-up to my question. Sorry.
I have a colleague, Greta Cron, who might be able to assist with that question, too. So.
Could you state your name, please?
Sure. I'm Greta Cron from Portland State University. I manage the technical details of our ESL and bilingual endorsement program, like scheduling classes and bringing the faculty on board and those sorts of things. So, and I wanted to address your question, Representative Klim. School districts are required by federal law to develop a local plan for how they intend to serve English language learners within their districts. It's called a LOW plan, and that's named after the initiator of the federal legislation. And each district has the opportunity to develop the programs and services that they believe best serve the English language learners within their districts. And there can be a variety of different approaches to that, as Dr. Roselli mentioned, and so it is up to the local districts to determine the best approaches, and I'm sure that there's research available. I'm sorry that I'm not aware of it, but I'm sure that there's research that exists that talks about different types of best practices, mm-hmm. and I know that some of those best practices are in place in some of our school districts in Oregon.
I'll follow up, Mr. Chair.
Just for one moment, I would like to note that when I heard Greta's name, I was very pleased. I haven't seen her for about 6 years, but she was at Chemeketa and helped run the College of Older Adults program, and I was one of their little faculty, came in and taught people how to do computers, and so I popped up, and it's so nice to see you again.
Nice to see you as well.
The one, I've had a conversation with one of my constituents about this, and he flagged something for me that when I went on my school tours, I noticed. I just wondered if this resonates with anyone. I learned to read largely in the libraries. I mean, there was a little bit in the classroom, but I spent so much time in the library, and I loved it. And I'd go, and the librarian would help me. And they're almost all dark now. I mean, I went there, and there was nobody in the libraries, including the teachers, or the librarians, they now call them something else. But some are only in the schools one day a week, and some, you know, 3 days a week, and there are not librarians anymore to just help you learn to read, whether it's English or anything else. And I just wonder if folks, you know, think maybe that's part of the problem too, and maybe that's part of the solution too, that if you had the libraries open again all the time, all the day, and then,
you know, you have the individual plans Greta talked about that are developed, and they can take place in the library instead of in the classroom, if that makes sense. If it's in the classroom, it's in the classroom, whatever's best for the student. But it's got to be hard when there's no books and there's no one who, that's their whole love in life, is to help you learn to read and research, you know, 4 days a week. Maybe that's a speech, not a question. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
I think everyone appreciated it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wouldn't disagree with Representative Clem, but it's also a responsibility of the local school board to, in the way that they are funding things, and they're falling down on the job in many cases. Anyway, I'm going to be the kind of the hard-hearted bastard here.
Pardon the expression.
And yes, pardon the expression. Here's what I'm having a problem understanding, and my two questions are, is the purpose of ESL training to teach teachers to teach in the language in our public schools other than English, or is it the ability to understand and teach English to students who come in speaking another language? And the reason why I ask that, and ask it the way I do, is because of the way what appears to be the focus of the programs, but also remembering back, remembering forward. If I were to decide that I wanted to move to Japan, I would have to learn Japanese. And if I couldn't function over there without learning Japanese, that's my problem, not their societal problem. If I wanted to move to Germany and teach in a German school over there, for example, I'd have to learn German. That's my responsibility. And if I wanted to function in their society, it's my responsibility, not their societal responsibility, to learn English so that I can understand them. When Representative Lim, I don't know if you notice, he's got a slight accent.
Strong accent,
yeah.
Not slight.
A strong accent. Okay, he will say a strong accent. When he came here in 1966 from Korea, it wasn't our job to learn Korean. It was his job to learn English if he wanted to function in American society, and he did that. And now he's been very successful over here, and here he is sitting next to me as a state legislator. I asked him if he still thinks in Korean or if he thinks in English, and I'll let him answer that question after I get done. But I think that we need to make sure that our public understands, because I have people in my legislative district say, you know what, it's up to them to learn English. It's not up to me to learn Spanish or French or German or Japanese or Korean or any other language. They're assimilating into the American culture. And while the American culture is, yes, a melting pot, it also is a primarily English-speaking. And there's a historical reason why we're English and not German, but I won't go into that. So that's my pitch. And the questions that I posed in there, and how you might want to respond.
Representative Krummel and Representative Buckley, I appreciate the need to clarify what is the purpose of ESOL preparation. I would probably point you to the descriptions of courses that are offered in our programs, because it's pretty clear that we're not trying to prepare teachers to teach in another language. We're preparing teachers to understand how language is acquired. And it is different than if a child walks in with the language versus a child walks in with a different language. And so helping understand how language is acquired and then how to scaffold learning for students who are acquiring that second language. And I must also say that when you're working with children who may be going back into a home environment in which the primary language is being spoken at night, their primary language is spoken at night, those children are switching back and forth continually between those two systems, which is very healthy for kids, but it also requires attention to the education that goes with that, and paying attention also to understanding the cultural nuances. There are things that we could do, and I can relate to some personal experiences where I could make a gesture or I could say something to an individual and not even understand why they might look perplexed. because I've not yet thought about the cultural differences that might exist between myself and that other individual. So I do see that part of our role is to help teachers be welcoming to those children, supportive of their immersion into an English-speaking culture, but also preserving their culture enough to help them stabilize while they're making that transition.
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, I would add to that some very practical considerations. First of all, at last count, my understanding is that there are more than 130 languages spoken in Oregon and among our school children. So, we are not educating our OUS students to be able to speak some or all of those languages. But also another practical consideration is the fact that our school districts are obligated to serve the students to the best of their ability that comes to them. And also we need to look beyond just the day-to-day instruction in the classrooms and think about the accountability that our schools are held to through No Child Left Behind and other mandates. And therefore, to prepare educators with the skills needed to move children through the pipeline is imperative. The children are not going to go off the face of the earth because perhaps another language is designated as being spoken. And it is particularly in an educational enterprise where we're looking from PK through 20 are imperative to assist in those efforts. And so what you're hearing today are overviews of how we fit into that system of preparing educators to go into those classrooms. These are not easy settings. It's just like going into a classroom and facing children with any type of disability or other special need. We are trying to give them the skills to go in with some level of confidence that they are able to meet the needs of those children.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Did you want to respond, sir, before follow-up?
I don't know that I can say it much better, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, than my colleagues have. I was just reflecting on when I was teaching kindergarten in Ashland and how I wish I had had this training myself, because I had a couple children who spoke Spanish. And I didn't. And it wasn't a matter of teaching them Spanish or teaching them English. It was a matter of how do you teach them anything when you can't communicate. And I wasn't able to meet their needs very well. And this is about helping every child learn, and even those who are English language learners yet. So that's really what it's about. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Graham, please follow.
Thank you, and I appreciate that very, very much. I'm curious. Two programs that I'm familiar with that are probably, in my estimation, what I would consider to be model programs for teaching, specifically immersion, and this is kind of following up, Dr. Roselli, on a comment that you made relative to immersion training. One is, of course, the LDS Church. I'm not LDS, but I went to the University of Utah and lived in Salt Lake for a few years, and so I'm very familiar with their program. And the first thing that someone that's going on a mission does, which they tend to do, is they go to Provo for eight weeks, and they're immersed in whatever language they're going to be for whatever country they're going to be at, and then they go out. The other is the State Department, and the State Department has a program that's very similar, and I'm familiar with that because a friend of mine is an undersecretary in the U.S. State Department. My question, though, is, and Dr. Roselli, you made a comment relative to, students is trying to learn in English at school, and then they go home, and the primary language at home is whatever their home country language is. What would happen if we were to require that for a student to be enrolled in an Oregon school, that the parents also had to attend an immersion training in English, so that it's not just one student or two students, but the entire family is now involved in learning English? Any thoughts on that? I mean, I don't have a bill, Mr. Chair, thinking about here. But I'm just wondering, because I think, you know, one of the things that we need to do, Mr. Chair, is try to figure out what kind of solutions we can have besides throwing more money at whatever we perceive the problem to be. And is that something that, and granted, I know that it would be probably an expensive proposition, but is that something, with your experience in languages, and all three of you really, is that something that is even feasible?
Chair Buckley and Representative Crummell, I mentioned earlier I previously lived in Florida for 40 plus years and actually worked closely with a number of schools that were serving migrant farm workers. And one of the things that impressed me the most was a very small school in the middle of the strawberry fields called Dover Elementary. And what was amazing was, first of all, their sign, it said, the world's best school. And secondly, the attitude was that way when you walked in the building, because they wrapped around the child, the family, and the community. So the school was used constantly, not only during the day to serve children, but in the evenings and afternoons around the work schedules of the parents. So they taught English. It's a very common model in places that have been dealing with these kinds of needs for a longer period than I think Oregon has. And I would suggest that those are some positive things. I would also note that watching the programs, they've not been easy to implement. First of all, there's transportation issues. There are timing issues. Sometimes you find that families are working more than one job and the idea of a regular program. So, but certainly we could provide you with some information on that, because I think the attempt to engage families in schools has to go beyond just inviting them to a meeting in which we talk in one language and talk about their kid, but it's also to serve them as well in being part of their child's education process. I'm working with a graduate student right now in Woodburn who is struggling with getting parents to come to evening events to talk about their children. She's been trying different strategies, and she herself speaks Spanish, which is interesting. And so there is still some sense of a reluctance to come into another institution of which I'm not familiar with that might ask me questions. I'll leave that one as is. But that is a big concern. So, but there are models out there.
Thank you. Doctor, I don't know if you noticed, but on the way in, there's a sign that says World's Best Legislature.
I have one comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
And my friend, Representative Crummell, sent me a note here. John, do you still think in Korean or do you still think in English? That's the question. He asked me, and I can say that when I dream nowadays, after 4 years in America, I came here 30 years old, when I dream in English nowadays. Mm-hmm. So, which means a pendulum swung toward the American way, but it took me a long time. Mm-hmm. So, my suggestion is language should be learned when they were young. Mm-hmm. It is very, very difficult teach a new trick to the old man. So.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was having a conversation with my mother-in-law. She came from Japan about 30 years ago, and she is somebody who believes that people should learn English just like I did. And I was talking to her. I said, okay, Azusa, here's my question to you, though. If what we're trying to do is, for example, get them to learn to read, and they learn to read better in their original language, you know, are you okay with teaching them to read in the original language? But, you know, we're trying to do this before the third grade. We're trying to get the transition done, but how you learn the language is through reading. And she was, you know, at first she had the hard line, and then she sort of stopped. She was, well, yeah, I guess that's okay. And so, you know, I have had this conversation a lot of times with a lot of my constituents, I think probably like Representative Crummell. And sometimes with a little more discussion, even they can sort of understand. But, you know, I haven't witnessed every situation out there they have, and sometimes they teach me something as well.
Okay, can I make one more
Representative Lim.
Comment? I'm sometimes perplexed why they call English as a second language.
Yeah.
English should be the first language in our country here. Then any other country should be a second language. You know, maybe we should turn around. But as you know, my son, when he became 5 years old, he already pointed, "Daddy, you speak very, you know, strong accent." He was born here, you know, as soon as he became to understand, he understand the differences, the way I pronounce differences of the American here.
I think we will never reach agreement on language terminology in education. Because, seriously, you can find 5 different terms in the literature very easily. I'm sorry, Representative Lim, I didn't address you.
I have a couple of quick questions. I do want to make sure that if there's anyone else who would like to testify, they have a chance. And also any closing comments you might have. Dr. Selle, in your testimony, you talked about working with Woodburn. And so I'm interested from our other two panelists. Do you have relationships with your local school districts? Is there communication? Do you know what the need is that you're trying to address, both in terms of numbers and content?
Chair Buckley, in terms of the Oregon University system, each of our campuses has those relationships with their regional districts. And so you will find in Eastern or Southern Oregon or Corvallis or wherever, Eugene, that the surrounding districts are hugely important in a number of ways, not only in terms of helping them, the university programs, have an up-to-date and current understanding of what's going on in their local areas, but also in terms of student-teacher placements. Remember that our educators, our students, have to go into a practicum before they finish their programs, and so those relationships are hugely important and exist across the state.
Very good. Yes, Mr. Chair, they're important for all of our programs, particularly for this program, for the ESL programs, however. And we have advisory committees for the school of education in general, but also for specific programs. As I mentioned in my testimony, we have roughly 50 adjunct faculty. These are people that come from the schools who provide input. They don't just teach in our program, but provide input to us. And I also should say, it's not just local districts that surround our campus, or I'm sure this is true for Hilda too, but you know, we offer our program in central Oregon as well as on the coast and, of course, in the Willamette Valley. So, you know, we're working with districts around the state.
It's probably an unfair question to follow with, but how far away are we in terms of, because the only testimony we've had thus far was from the Woodburn School District, who said, "We simply don't have nearly enough teachers." What would be nearly enough? How far away are we from reaching a point where, in your estimation, the three of you, that we would actually be at the point of adequacy in our system? Hard to say.
Chair Buckley, I would only suggest that we'd have to look at the demographics of the communities. When I work with Salem-Keizer school districts, they are experiencing a larger increase of individuals moving into their community for jobs, for whom English is their second language. But when you look at a smaller community, you might not find that. But then on the other hand, I live right down the street from, well, I actually live in Central School District. Central School District, because it has a large migrant population and a large farm worker constituency, 40% of those students are speaking a second language. So it's really hard to get a number. I'm certainly that we could get estimates if we polled our, school personnel. OSPA may be able to provide a better picture on that. I'm busy trying to work with the districts that come to me and say, "Can you help?"
I understand. I think the reason I brought it up, Doctor, is in the testimony that we had yesterday, mm-hmm. Which we can get a copy of to you as well.
Appreciate
the projections on demographics were quite startling of where we're heading. And that information might be able to give the systems the ability to be able to say, well, if we are looking at if the growth of Hispanic or Asian or Russian students is estimated to be this in the next 5 or 10 years, that obviously might give us the kind of benchmarks we'd want to make. And my Minister did mention, too, that the Quality Education Commission has done work on this as well in terms of what the need would be.
And Chair Buckley, I would add also that given those changing demographics across the state, one thing that I think is going to be very important, not only is it the production of new teachers in this area, but also the professional development of those who are in the field.
Good
and
point.
Really building upon the resources that currently exist and providing, where appropriate, some additional opportunities for endorsements and skills in the areas across the board. Because remember, these skills are needed from the beginning of the educational environment through high school.
Yeah, all the way through. Yeah. Thank you. Members, have we...
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Arena.
Can I just make a comment, please?
Yes.
As I sit here and listen to this, I really think back in my heritage, where my grandparents and their age cohort came to the United States from Eastern Europe in the time period between 1900 and 1927, the passage of the Karen Act, and how they all came without English as a language, and how important it was for they, and particularly for their children, to learn English in ways that weren't necessarily very easy, to become a part of the society that they live in. And I think about a wonderful book that really influenced me as a young person called My Name is Hyman Cohn, about an adult learner trying to struggle with the idiomatic nature of the English language and trying to learn English, but how important that was. And I just want to comment how important what you're doing is to help this very large part of a generation in this state and other states come into society in a way that they, and certainly their children at least, have a chance to have the opportunities to achieve that we want everybody to have. And I just want to comment on how much I admire what you're doing and how very important it is to our society.
Well, at the risk of defeating that moment, do you have any final comments you'd like to make?
Mr. Chair, I just want to express how I appreciate that comment. My grandmother didn't speak English when she started school either. A couple points that I hope we're doing better today than we did in my grandmother's day. Number one, I don't think she received the kind of education that she should have because she couldn't relate and that nobody spoke her language in the school. Number two, I sure wish I spoke German today. And we look at these English language learners, and of course we want them all to speak English and dream in English. But what a gift if they will be bilingual and their children will be bilingual as well. So these children are tremendous assets, and that's what we're trying to accomplish here, to do the best for them.
Thank you. I have to make note of the Phoenix Elementary School. I don't know if you followed their program, but they do have the dual immersion program in the lower grades, and it's amazing to watch the English speaking children learn Spanish speaking children to learn English, and how that's happening at that young age that you were talking about.
Same program at the same time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same program at the same time. And it's in fact, they were the superintendent acknowledged them as being one of the schools that's making the most rapid progress in closing the academic gap. It's really quite a remarkable program. So next time any of you are in Jackson County, I'd be glad to host you over at Phoenix Elementary. Doctors, thank you all three for being here. Thank you, as Representative Greenwood says, thank you for your work. Best of luck. Please feel you always have an open door here in the best legislature in the world, and that you can please communicate with us on progress that you make and ways that we can help you with your work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't think, do we have anybody signed
no.
up? We didn't have anyone signed up, but if there is anyone who's been listening to the conversation for the last hour and a half, we'd like to come. Please do. Please come up and let us know your thoughts. If you'd be so kind as to identify yourself for the record before you begin, we'd appreciate it.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Vicki Chamberlain. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And I didn't sign up because I didn't know whether I'd have anything to truly add to the conversation and wanted to listen first, so I hope you'll indulge me. I had a couple of thoughts. One of them is I think it's helpful to, if the question is, are we preparing enough teachers who can assist second language children, we have to ask other questions, and that is, even if we did, could we get them where they need to go? Which is actually one of our huge demand and supply issues we have in the state. I looked in the Oregon report card, and we have 71,517 students identified with disabilities in out of our 559,000 total students. That compares to 65,239 students identified as being English not their first language. So right now, our ELL, our English language learners, are 11.7% of our overall school population. That compares to 41,231 TAG students. I mean, my point is I think that we have high concentrations of students in areas, and the issue is how do we serve them well where they are. So we have districts in the state that have one English language learning student. We have some districts in the state that have none. And then we have Woodburn, who has 69% of underrepresented folks. And so I think the solutions lie in finding money available for Woodburn to train their existing and incoming staff as quickly as possible if they're unable to find the actually already pre-educated students. That way you can supply in the area. We are always hearing we have a shortage of special education teachers, and our shortage is in the rural areas. So even if we had, I suspect we have enough numbers, but you can't compel somebody to live somewhere they don't want to live, and that always becomes our paradigm issue. So I think the solution truly does lie in allowing school districts to get the resources they need on the spot to do the work they need to do with staff who are willing to live there. There are states who address this supply demand by housing and other solutions. We haven't gone that far, but I just wanted to throw that into the mix. And just on one sort of up note, we do have a new program that's going to be coming to the commission for approval that everyone enrolled in their program will come out with an English to speakers of other languages. That's what we call the endorsement, ESOL, acronym number two, as required as part of their program in their effort to meet the demand in the communities. So everyone is being extremely creative, including the examples you heard up here from these two deans, and wanted to let you know that they're working hard. And one final thought. They said it. I'm not sure it was very expressed, but as Dean Roselli pointed out, we may not have the capacity to serve everyone in that manner if they came through, and that has to be examined also. But I hope those comments help.
Very helpful. Appreciate that very much. Any questions? Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chamberlain, thanks for coming up and sharing some of those numbers. Do you think, you know, one of the things that we've tried to do a few years ago when I was on the Health Committee, Mr. Chair,
yes,
we were told by folks over in John Day, for example, that when they're recruiting a physician, they don't recruit the physician. They go recruit the spouse, or they recruit the
counselor.
And it's very true. But I'm curious, you know, because one of the things that we've done in healthcare, and I think, I don't know whether it's been successful or not, but as Representative Greenlick knows, is that we've tried to incentivize, for example, physicians to move into an area, to move to John Day and to Burns and places like that by providing, you know, telemed, by making sure, but also by with tax incentives and that sort of thing. Do you think that those types of incentives could work for teachers?
Well, Representative Crummel and Chair Buckley, in some states, they have evidence that it does, actually. Sometimes part of the issue is whether or not they can get housing and settle in and become part of the community. It's not the full solution.
Mm-hmm.
I think the solution truly is in assisting universities to have partnerships with school districts, like was demonstrated up here, to be recruiting through our community colleges. I was also going to point out, when I worked at Chemeketa, the English language learning adult classes were at maximum capacity. They could not serve them quickly enough. And so we have an ability, you know, a capacity issue. So I do think that if we can acknowledge that there's a learning level that teachers start at, and then you go to a community and there's identified needs, the district should have the ability to provide the staff development in conjunction with a university like Woodburn is doing. They use the Willamette curriculum, and they're doing a fabulous, it's an incredibly innovative plan they have.
Yeah, I really like the push of seeing exactly what exists on the ground and making sure the local districts have the resources to make it work in their situation. I very much appreciate you coming forward. Any other questions, gentlemen? I'm going to close the public hearing, and thank you very much. Close public hearing, informational meeting. But, gentlemen, before I adjourn, I do want to request your assistance. I'm hoping sometime in the month of February we can have one meeting where perhaps Representative Greenlit, Representative Crummell, and Representative Lim and I can work to have a hearing where Representative Clem doesn't know anybody who testifies, you know, on a personal basis.
And he won't say one thing.
with that as a goal for the coming month, I'll adjourn this meeting. Thank you.
No.